All right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. You heard a bit of Firestarter there, and it's a sad week. Keith Flint from The Prodigy took his life by the sounds of it this week, which is really sad. That one hit me pretty hard, to be honest. He was a Prodigy, along with Oasis and Pulp, were probably my big three bands in the 90s. I absolutely loved the first album, Jilted Generation, especially. And then saw them supporting Oasis at Nebworth, which was absolutely incredible. And I've said them here before, I think as a performance, probably better than Oasis. You know, they absolutely had the crowd going. It was absolutely incredible that day. And obviously Oasis playing was a bit special, but what they were able to achieve on that stage was just amazing, mind-blowing. I saw them a couple of other times as well, once at Reading Rivermead, like the next year. And I couldn't quite understand it, because no one was really jumping up and down, which I was used to at gigs. Everyone was kind of standing, dancing on the spot, chewing furiously, drinking water, and I didn't quite understand it. But I kind of figured out what happened a bit later. But I've mentioned on here before, I mean, it even goes back further than that. I mean, I was into The Prodigy before I was ever into Oasis, and actually I credit The Prodigy with kind of discovering my love of the bass, listening to the track Poison and just hearing that bass come in and thinking, what is this? This is another level. Blew my mind. And then also a track like Voodoo People, I'd been listening to a lot of dance music and then a lot of rock music, and I was wondering, well where's the combination of the two? Why can't someone merge rock music and dance music? And then Jilted Generation comes out with Voodoo People, and it was like, wow, these guys have done it. This is amazing. And they went on to obviously take that up a notch with the Fat of the Land album, which had a lot more of those rock influences. And then they carried on into a lot of their later stuff as well. So very sad news about Keith Flint. He will be missed. On to the main topic of today's episode, which is we will be interviewing Davey Lane. Davey is an Australian musician. He's in a band called You Am I, and it's an incredible story of how he ended up in that band. He's then also met the Oasis guys a few times, and he tells some absolutely brilliant stories about meeting Noel, meeting Liam. It's really good. He's a great storyteller, so I hope you guys really enjoy that. We also go into a little bit of Born on a Different Cloud for the Oasis A to Z segment, but we're not going to fully do that today. We'll come back because I've got some good stuff to cover off on that next time around as well. So we will catch up on Born on a Different Cloud again. I hope you enjoy the interview with Davey. Couple of other bits of Oasis news. A few days ago, Ian Robertson and Tim Abbott, I've mentioned that they've been doing these visits around the country. They've done a couple, they've got a couple more coming up, I think, doing this talks and showing some footage. If you remember, Richard Bowes reviewed the one last time, and he said, yeah, there were some good bits of footage, but they didn't really play a huge amount. Well, they played in Sheffield a few days ago, and they did play some footage of Step Out. And this was Liam recording, singing Step Out. Now, apparently they did ask for no one to record, but a couple of people did. And it leaked, And thank God it leaked, because it's absolutely amazing. So yeah, I've been in touch with Ian and Tim, and I don't think they were particularly happy about it at first, but then it's caused such a stir. Obviously it's been pretty good for them, because it's good publicity for next time they do a live event. So I don't think they were too upset about it leaking in the end. But yeah, make sure you look out for those guys next time they're on the road. But let's have a little bit, shall we? Here's Liam doing Step Out. This is the original recording, and then a YouTube mashup of it with an instrumental version that's found on the internet, and then we just go into the original version just for comparison.
She looks just like a star in a tacky world, but I need to light up my own, because you might think you're gonna cry. You will be alright, step out tonight. You
In other Oasis news, I had a bit of a kind of exclusive the other day. A friend of mine who is a songwriter and has access to the PRS website, which is the Performing Rights Society. I think there are other ways of getting in and logging in. So this is public information, but no one sort of looked for it before. Liam Gallagher has got some songs listed that haven't been released. So they are listed on this sort of official Performing Rights Society website, but we haven't heard of them other than that. So the names are Anything's Possible, Dart Royalties, No One Loves Like You Do, and then Alar's there, but we know about Alar. So Anything's Possible and Dart Royalties, we've never heard of before. They are completely out of nowhere. No One Loves Like You Do, that could be I Get By, because that was the working title for I Get By. So it could be they've logged that as a song, but then just haven't taken it off once they rewrote that song as I Get By. But yeah, Anything's Possible, fine, normal, standard name. Dart Royalties. What? What the hell's that about? And someone Googled it, and it sort of relates to royalties relating to digital recordings, which is... You know, is that inspired a song, or could it be an attack on Noel? Well, it's a bit quick if he suddenly sort of thought of that and logged it now with the whole Noel not allowing him to include the songs in the documentary. So yeah, very strange. But yeah, let me know what you think of those names. Anything's Possible, Dart Royalties, and then potentially No One Loves Like You Do. Unless that was I Get By. And in other news, there's been a few more gigs booked. Noel is going to Italy in June. Noel is also playing with the Smashing Pumpkins in a bunch of American shows in August, which I think is a nice idea. Sort of similar, it reminds me of when Oasis played with the Black Crowes in America, when Steve White stepped in for that tour. Yeah, it makes sense if it's a good chance to sort of play to a bunch of people that maybe wouldn't be going to see Noel. Liam is being tipped to play the Manchester International Festival in July, which would be a sort of a small acoustic-y type show. Noel's doing a show in Seoul, the Olympic Park. And also Noel's releasing an EP for Record Store Day called Wait and Return, which is remixes of High Flying Birds tracks I was a little bit disappointed at first because we thought it might be new material, but it's not. So there's She Taught Me How to Fly, Reflex Revision, Keep on Reaching, Reflex Revision, and Black and White Sunshine, Richard Norris Remix. Liam is playing in Spain on July 27th. He's also playing in Bilbao in Spain on July the 11th. Noel's playing in Holland in June. And yeah, this was interesting. The Who website mentioned that Dave Sardy, who has previously worked with Oasis and also Noel solo, it just mentioned in passing that he's off going off to work with Noel and then he'll be back with us or something like that. You think, oh, that's interesting, because no one had mentioned that at all. So yeah, it sounds like Dave Sardy will be doing some production with Noel, whether that's separate or on top of the tracks that he's done with David Holmes, we don't know. Anyway, I think that should do it for now. So let's go on to this interview with Davey Lane. Davey, as I said, is a really good fun guest, so I hope you guys really enjoy this, and I'll see you on the other side.
Yep, I've got I've got Pro Tools going, so I've got my my headphones plugged into the to my phone. I'm talking to you on that, and I'm just I've just got my mic set up, just going straight into Pro Tools. So
perfect. So you're going to stick reverb on it and make yourself sound wonderful, and I'm just talking
exactly.
into it.
Yeah,
I'm gonna sound like a shitty old iPad.
Yeah, I'm gonna sound like a like the Dalai Lama on the top of Mount Everest.
Exactly. Yeah. Was it 10,000 monks chanting or something?
There That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, how the hell are you, man? What's going on?
I'm good. I'm in my hometown of Melbourne, and mm-hmm. I've just moved into a new place and getting a new studio set up in my home. And hence the microphone. I'm just I'm doing lots of this clapping around the room to see where the good echoes are, like any musician who doesn't really know how to do that.
Yeah,
does.
Or like a mad person. It's sort of there's
or like a mad person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you doing, David? Yeah. I'm just walking around the room clapping. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretending like I know why I'm clapping.
No, I mean, I was just going to ask you about that actually, because your stuff, and we'll get into it, but you know, when you hear, so your main job, correct me if I'm wrong, but is being the guitarist in the band UMI.
That's right. Yep.
And then you've got all this solo work that you've done. And so normally when you hear of, okay, guitar player from a quite a big rock band, indie band does their own side projects, you think, oh, okay, that's going to be sort of Graham Coxon, scratchy demos, or, you know, very...
Yeah, or kind of like melancholic acoustic guitar
exactly.
ruminations, you know.
Yeah. They wouldn't let me put these 12 songs about suicide on the album, so, you know, I'm going
exactly.
to use it here. Yeah, whereas actually your stuff is bold and big and psychedelic and huge, and it's like, what? This isn't solo album stuff. This is like massive rock band, you know, taking over the world stuff. And is it all recorded at home? Because it's like, no, this has got to be Abbey Road sort of, you know, this stuff's huge.
Yeah. Well, one can dream, and I'm lucky to have a fertile imagination. So I record all my own stuff at home, but I'm imagining obviously all my influences get thrown into a blender and it comes out sounding like something, even though I will gladly say as our heroes do that I wear my influences on my sleeve, but I imagine I am for a brief period in time I'm Jeff Lynne or Nick Lowe or Todd Rundgren or Noel Gallagher if one may dare say, but all my favorite music is along those lines. It's basically pop music, but it's kind of euphoric pop music, and I probably wouldn't want to waste I probably wouldn't want to waste my own time writing morose songs about suicide or even though sometimes those I find it great to dress up the because you never get the best songs from everything being Skittles and beer and sunshine and lollipops, the best songs do come from kind of dark places sometimes, but if you dress them up in a nice melody and some sort of grandiose production stylings, then that kind of ticks my boxes, I guess.
No, it's brilliant. We've talked before, but I do really, really enjoy your stuff, and I've sort of turned on a few people to it because.
That's
all right. And I mean, the closest I've got to it in from like recent UK bands was Temples, when Temples came out about 4 or 5 years ago. I don't know if that's
right.
Familiar with.
I am. Yeah.
Yeah. No. So when they came out, it was straight away. It's like, what's this? This is fantastic. And. But it always feels a bit wrong because they sound like they're recording in like 1968, and so you're like, I love this new band, because it sounds like they're recording in 1968. So it feels a little bit wrong because surely if you're supporting new, it should sound new, not like 50 years old.
I guess so. But a lot of the for me, my favourite song of 2018 was a song. An offcut from Village Green Preservation Society by the Kinks, that song Time Song, that's my favourite song of 2018, even though it was recorded in 1968 or 1971 or whenever it was. I do love keeping my ear to the ground for new music, but I always end up inevitably going back and mining the old stuff.
Time lives our lives with us, walks side by side with us. Time is so far from us, but time is among us. Time is ahead of us, above and below us, is standing beside us and looking down on us. When we were young, our bodies were strong, we thought we'd sail into sunsets when our time came along.
You just can't beat it. There was just something magic in the air between, I've sort of narrowed it down to about 65 to about 69 is just what I always gravitate towards, whether it's what's happening in like America with Motown and Stax and Atlantic, or what was happening in the UK or even on the West Coast. It's that tends to be I don't know what it is, that's me.
Those were 4 years in music history where it's like where it was possible to, and luckily we have the music made by those kind of people, made by whether it be like McCartney or Lennon or Ray Davies or Townsend or you know, like even like, you know, Sid Barrett and Nick Drake. Or I'm only naming English people at the moment.
I was
but
say, it's all English.
Yeah, but you know, luckily those people had fertile imaginations as well, and they, you know, they were able to do things that no one had ever done before. So.
Well, just to get people caught up, if they don't know who you are and your story, I think of you as the Australian Richard Oakes. So, you know, Richard Oakes
from Suede. Yeah, from Suede. Yeah.
Now, this is the ultimate story, right? The ultimate dream of, like, the, you know, the schoolboy playing football suddenly gets signed to come and play for Man United or something like that. You know, this is unbelievable. Yeah. So just, do you want to just give us the sort of the 2-minute version of where you were and what happened?
I'll try and keep it succinct. Yeah, when I was in high school, it would have been like I started playing guitar around the age of 13 or 14 years old, properly. Even though at a much earlier age, I was turned on to, like my dad brought home a VHS copy of The Kids All Right, the Who movie
documentary. Love him. Yeah.
Documentary, yeah. And I saw, as a, you know, an awkward, geeky little kid, I watched Pete Townsend play guitar and thought, I want to do that. Like, that's a way of communicating how I feel without having to talk, or you know, like, it was just like there was something, like, even as a young kid who didn't know much, I knew there was something so visceral about that form of communication. So that was when I decided to trade in the trombone that my dad had bought me for a guitar. So I had the guitar sitting there for a little while and kind of while I was trying to learn how to, I remember watching, and this is quite a funny thing. Actually, I'm not being so succinct about it now, but I remember my dad sitting down with my dad watching TV. And it was like a Dire Straits live at Wembley Stadium or something. And I was trying to learn how to play guitar. And it was like, I looked at Mark Knopfler and was like, he can do that and he can sing as well. Which I think in hindsight is kind of arguable that he could sing anyway. But
right, okay.
But but anyway, then to cut a longer story shorter, I got onto this band UMI, who were a band, like, in as a 13 or 14 year old, hearing, and this is where Oasis comes into the story as well, like, hearing I was so into The Who and the Beatles, they were my obsession when I was around that age, and to hear bands like UMI were a local Australian band, and to hear bands like Oasis and Supergrass, who kind of imbued the spirit of all these amazing groups, but doing their own thing and doing it in the current day, like, that really kind of set a light bulb up in my brain, you know. The UMI records later, a friend of mine was doing their website, and I remember looking up, it was actually at the time I wanted to play some UMI songs on guitar, so I looked up their tab page on their fan website, and I kind of, like, it's one of those things where, you know, I don't know, like, folks out there who play guitar, like, who you look up a tab and you kind of play it, and it's like, oh, that doesn't sound...
It's close.
That doesn't sound right. Yeah. So I kind of got into, like, nutting out Tim, who sings and writes the songs in UMI, like, and got into nutting out his guitar tunings and all that kind of thing. So I started making my own tabs for that website, and a few months later I got to meet the guys. I was still in last year of high school here, and got to meet them and got to get up on stage and play guitar with them. And then I was only supposed to play one song, and then at the end of that song, Tim turned around and goes, do you know this song? I was like, yeah, I know how to play that. He's like, okay, keep playing. And then we got to the end of that song, and he was like, do you know how to play Purple Sneakers? And I was like, yeah, I know how to play that. And he's like, okay, keep playing. So, like, I ended up playing, like, four or five songs when I was only supposed to play one song. So we got off stage and we hung out, and I had, like, I'm sure in hindsight I had kind of, like, you know, I kind of nerded them out, and it's like, oh, well, what are you doing this song? It's like, oh, yeah, there's a little drum fill in this song where it doesn't sound like it's like, it sounds like it's maybe three bars to the beat instead of, it's like shut up, you little nerd. So so they went away on tour. They went to the States for about 3 months, and I didn't hear anything from. I mean, like, obviously, you know, like, so I wasn't sat by the phone going, "Why hasn't my favourite band called me to say g'day?" But anyway, so 3 months goes by, and in that time,
we were best friends.
Yeah, I know. We're going to hang out. We're going go play pinball, but. Yeah, so they were on tour, and in that time I finished high school and I'd started a university course.
Okay.
And I was one day into this university course, and I knew it wasn't for me. I just didn't fit in with other people. I didn't fit in with being at university. I was basically doing it for my mum and dad, you know, because that's what they wanted me to do. So, and then at the end of the second day, the phone rings, and it's Tim, who is Tim from UMI, and he says to me, "I'm putting out a solo record, and I'm going on tour next week, and I need another guitar player. Would you like to play?" And, you know,
let me think about it. Yes, please.
Yeah. Let me think about it. That sounds great. Thank you very much. And he was like, okay, I'm going to drive out tomorrow and we're going to play through the songs. And then we start rehearsal on Saturday. And I was like, okay, that sounds great. So I went back to university the next day and told them that I had to go on tour with one of my, you know, someone who I greatly admired in music, and they said, "You can't do that." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I'm going." So I ended up doing 2 days of my university course, and I could re-enroll at any time, but it's been 20 years now, so
those library books are really overdue, man.
Do they even have library books anymore?
I don't know. I just remember when I was there, it was a thing that people who had library books overdue, they wouldn't let you graduate unless you took them back and paid the fine. So there's a bunch of us go up on the like having to hand over like £100 or something, which is a lot of money.
That's very Seinfeld-esque. It's a Seinfeld episode where there's the librarian who comes after Jerry Seinfeld because he has a book that's 20 years overdue.
You took this book out in 1971.
Yes, and I returned it in 1971.
Yeah, 71. That was my first year on the job. Bad year for libraries. Bad year for America. Hippies burning library cards. Abby Hoffman telling everybody to steal books. I don't judge a man by the length of his hair or the kind of music he listens to. Rock was never my bag. But you put on a pair of shoes when you walk into the New York Public Library, fella.
Look, Mr. Bookman. I returned that book. I remember it very specifically.
You're a comedian. You make people laugh.
I try.
You think this is all a big joke, don't you?
That's another tangent.
Yeah, that's the Seinfeld podcast. But so So you did this solo tour with Tim.
Yeah, so I did the solo tour with Tim, and in hindsight, touring Australia is not like touring the UK, where you can get in a van and you drive for even for a couple of hours, so you get in a van in Liverpool and you drive for like however long it is, an hour, and you get to Manchester, or like you go to Chester or wherever it is. And but like Australia is nowhere near as densely populated, but like it is quite a bigger country. So playing to play shows, like you would have to fly, basically. If you like to go from Melbourne to Sydney is like an hour on an aircraft, but we were able to fill in 30 dates, so we did a lot of travel and a lot of flying, and I learnt the ropes in a very condensed period of time, I guess you could say. So we'd finished his solo tour, and then after that it was kind of the idea was raised that maybe I might have even just jump into a rehearsal room with UMI and see how that goes. So we did that, and then it was about 2 days after that we played my first show with the band in Auckland, which was in itself a terrifying experience, because I'd only come out of high school and playing with my high school band, playing covers of Richard III and The Girl in the Dirty Shirt in our school at lunchtimes in the schoolyard. Yeah. And like they'd have a thing where they'd set up a little piano. So that was my only experience of kind of playing in a rock band. And then the UMI thing was, I mean, that was like kind of being thrown into the fire. Like,
yeah. And what size crowds is that? What size crowds are UMI playing to?
Well, the Auckland show was probably about 1,500 people. But the next show we played after that was... It was a Tibetan Freedom concert, but it was in Sydney, and it was probably a couple of years after the one in the States that Noel played at. But that was probably about, I guess, 10,000 people, and that was my second show with the band. So that was.
And you're 18.
I was 18. Yeah. So like, and I wonder where my like. Deep-seated anxiety comes from. It's probably like probably getting, yeah, no, I'm sure it comes from other sources, but yeah. That was the second show that I played with the band, and that was crazy. Something else.
This is Terrence Trent D'Arby on lead guitar.
That is crazy. So, so yeah, and then so getting onto the Oasis side of it, because, you know, this is the Oasis podcast after all.
Absolutely. So we're here to talk about Oasis.
So you missed when UMI supported Oasis, right, by about six... Sorry, that's the way around. By about 6 months. Yeah, that must have been a bit annoying for you.
Well, it was annoying, but I went to the show anyway. Like, I actually, when I say 6 months, it's probably like 6 months before I had like met the guys, really. So I think I think from memory, the Oasis show would have been like February or March 98, I think.
Okay.
And, you know, I was riding the wave of Be Here Now mania, and I was one of the people who wasn't disappointed by it, but like, I was kind of more enamored by the audaciousness and you know, just the whole thing just appealed to my sensibilities, I guess. Yeah. It's like, do everything big, do everything like, make it go for 8 minutes, I don't care. Like,
yeah.
But
well, you've mentioned the Who and ELO. Exactly. They never shied away from being big.
Yeah. Well, and I'm a fan of Queen as well. Or probably more so Brian May as a guitar player. But when you talk about grandiosity and rock music, they kind of like, they're up there. So I saw them play at in Melbourne with UMI supporting, and I thought, wow, that, you know, I was like, wow, my two favorite bands, this is great. So I saw UMI played a great show, and I think I'm trying to put myself back in the frame of mind at the time, but I think I was maybe possibly a little not deflated by Oasis's performance, but I think possibly at that part of the tour, they were kind of towards the tail end of that Be Here Now tour, and you could tell that they were a little bit kind of done, you know, they were ready to get off the road.
Yeah.
You know? But having said that, I mean, I still had a good old time, and still, I was trying to think what songs I'd be here now. I think by that point, they only played maybe Stand By Me, and actually, Tim from UMI tells me, I'm sure he won't mind me retelling this story, but the first show that UMI played with Oasis was at the Budokan in Japan, the famous Budokan of
The Beatles,
you know,
played.
Like, the Beatles and, you know, Cheap Trick and Deep Purple and all that kind of stuff. But Noel went up to Tim and said, "Oh, hey Tim, you know, what songs you? What, is there a song you like to hear us play?" And sorry, that's an awful Mancunian accent, but.
That was more Liverpool.
Yeah. Actually, sorry. No, I was doing Paul McCartney then,
wasn't
I? You were
doing Paul McCartney, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Well, you know, the great thing about that song is... He's like, all right, what fucking song do you want to hear us play? All right. Tim said, I've always loved Some Might Say. Can you play Some Might Say? And so the next show, Noel comes out in his solo with, you know, and Tim being a fan of big, blustery rock and roll music, which is what one of Oasis's strong points. That Noel comes out on acoustic guitar and goes, "This is for Tim," and plays Some Might Say in this really languid, slow acoustic kind of. And Tim was like, "Oh, that's great, but that's not the way it's I wanted to
I
hear
wanted,
it."
Can you do it again, but with the band, please?
Exactly. Yeah,
the only person to ever have a Noel song dedicated to them that was disappointed by it.
Yeah. Goodness, well, yeah.
We will find it right today. I'm standing at the station, need of education in the brain.
And then, so when do you, you said it's sort of at 2002 was the first time you actually met them.
Yeah, they were, actually, you and I were on tour. I think we're in the States. We were on tour with, because the year before that, in 2001, we brought the Strokes out to Australia, and it wow. was, it was just, it was kind of the thing where we heard their first their first EP and thought, oh, this band is fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. We have to, like, and we got in touch with them and we kind of, they were like, yep, we'll come out to Australia, this is great. And in the time between us booking them and then them coming out, they'd kind of been you know, they'd taken up 10 of the last 15 NME covers and whatnot, you know, like it
went
in that time,
it
had just completely blown up. And so by the time they got out here, they were they were huge overseas, but like still in Australia, Australia being, you know, being kind of 20 years behind the rest of the world, where like they had caught up on the Strokes yet. I mean that in an endearing way, but so the Strokes came out and supported us. They went back home, and then the year after that, they took us over to there. So we were on. We did, I think, the Midwest with them. We did like maybe like 8 or 10 shows with the Strokes, and by that time they all had their own buses. And
wow.
I remember talking to Fab, the drummer, who was really bummed out after one gig, and I said, "Oh, well, what's wrong? Are you all right?" And he goes, "Oh man, I just saw a picture of my girlfriend. She was making out the guy." And so, "Oh man, that sucks." Like, and he goes, "Oh, where'd you see that?" And he goes, "Oh, I saw it in People magazine." And then so I realized, "Oh, that's right. You're talking about Drew Barrymore." Right, okay.
That is crazy, isn't it? That's crazy. They'd gone from this little, I mean, they all had heritage though, didn't they? You had Albert Hammond, was, you know, his dad's very famous and things like that. So
I know
they were already sort of New York socialite kids that, you know, they weren't these sort of scruffy garage band kids. They were kind of celebrities.
They were poised
like rich kids, weren't they? Yeah.
Exactly. Poised for success. Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, not to detract from what they did, but they were very good at it.
Yeah, because the music's amazing.
Yeah. But they, so we're on tour with them, and then we came home, and Oasis were doing 4 nights, and they were on tour in Australia playing a festival that no longer exists called the Livid Festival, and they were doing that run, and I was pretty disappointed that, I mean, you know, like, I was pretty disappointed we were on tour in America with the Strokes, but I was, you know, how unappreciative does that sound? But I was pretty disappointed that I was going to miss Oasis, because by the time we got back, they would have finished that festival, and they ended up announcing like 3 nights at a theater in Melbourne called the Forum, which holds about 1500 people, which, like, for the kind of shows that Oasis were playing in 2002, like, that's I mean, relatively tiny. You know, they ended up announcing I think the day before we left to come back home, they ended up announcing another show. So which went on sale the day after I got home. So I made sure, my girlfriend at the time made sure we got tickets and we went down. And Tim was there as well, because he got a call from Noel to come down and check out the show. So we went back to the hotel afterwards, and this band and these people who were so integral to my, you know, my musical enlightenment as a teenager, and we, Tim took me, okay, come and meet Noel, and it's like, and Tim's like, Noel, this is our new guitar player, Davey, and then like shook his hand, and he just like looked me up and down, and he goes, yeah, well, you fucking look like one of them, don't you? And then and then he walked up. I guess I'll take that as a compliment, or but later on we kind of sitting around at the bar, a lot of people had kind of trailed off and gone to bed. I met Gem for the first time that night, and I met Alan White. I kind of bailed him up about his drum sounds on that last record that he played on. And but we were sitting around with Noel, and Noel was like, all right, everybody, what's your favourite Beatles record? And went one by one, there's maybe seven or eight of us sat around, and goes, okay, what's your fucking favourite Beatles record? And I was like, oh, well, I don't know, I can't remember what I said at the time. It was like, I remember my ex-girlfriend said, like, oh, my favourite is Beatles for Sale. And he goes, fucking Beatles for Sale? Fucking Mr. Moonlight? Fuck off. Fucking rubbish, man. I remember at the time I was really I still am, but I was really into the band and Sid Barrett. And
right,
he's said, oh, are you into any Sid Barrett stuff? And he goes, oh, it's fucking, you know, bit fucking weird for me, you know.
Yeah.
But and I asked him about the band, and he said, oh, I like Rag Mama Rags, all right, but yeah, the rest of it's fucking oaky, fucking country music, innit? And so, well, yeah, well, I guess it depends how you look at it, really. But anyway, so back to the Beatles.
I was going
to
say, no, you're completely wrong about that.
Yeah. I was like, well, you know, there's no trying to let, you know, if someone is as kind of stoic and set in their opinion as him, there's no kind of trying to reason with one. So I said, oh, what's your favourite Beatles album? And he goes, the Blue Album.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Well,
it makes sense, because, you know, like I talked about it with a friend of mine afterwards, and so, well, you know, Noel writes singles, so it would make sense that his favourite Beatles album would be the compilation.
That's so hilarious. You know that Alan Partridge clip where he says,
I would have to say the best of the Beatles.
Yes, absolutely. Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew?
That's exactly
on the same line as Noel Gallagher.
Whose is it?
It's mine.
I didn't know you were into music. Oh, I know you're a DJ, but I've heard your show.
Yeah, I mean, I like all the bands. I've got a broad taste, you know, from the Britpop bands like UB40, Def Leppard, right back to classic rock like Wings.
Who's Wings?
They're only the band the Beatles could have been.
Well, I love the Beatles.
Yeah, so do I.
What's your favourite Beatles album then?
Tough one. I think I'd have to say The Best of the Beatles.
That's exactly what I thought of when he said, tough one.
I have to say The Best of the Beatles.
Oh my god, I'm so looking forward to this new Partridge thing next week.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I've been hanging out for it. Yeah. Anyway.
Cool. But yeah, so you've so that all went down okay then, that 2002 meeting.
Yeah, that was fine. We like it was a good night. I went home thinking, oh fuck, I had a funny chat to Noel Gallagher, and that's all I could really ask for in this. And I saw Oasis play. All boxes ticked, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And then yeah. And then in very different settings, you meet him in 2003 in Dingwalls.
We played a UMI show at Dingwalls in London in Camden, and I had no idea could I take just 1 second?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
sure, just 1 second, I'll be right back.
Okay.
Stay on the line.
Yeah, no worries.
Sorry about that. You there?
Yeah, yeah, I'm here. No worries.
Cool. Sorry, I finished my beer, so I had to go and get another one.
You realise you are living up to the Australian stereotype.
Yeah, no worries, mate. All right.
Just sucking back on shrimps on the barbie.
Yeah, yeah. Sucking back on a brew. Anyway,
and we're back
where
in
were
the
we? 2003... Dingwalls.
Yeah.
Yeah, we played a UMI show. Yeah, Dingwalls. And I think we'd been... It maybe was the last show of a tour. We were in Europe. We were in the UK for maybe a month. We did a tour with the Vines. And
Wow.
And after that, we did a tour with Evan Dando as well. Like, so we kind of finished with the Vines and then... went and met Evan Dando in Glasgow and joined that tour. And at the end of the run, I can't remember if we played with Evan in London. I don't think we did, but we supported the Vines at Brixton Academy. And so we thought we'd do our own little club show at the end of the tour. And we had one of our bands, big heroes, Billy Childish, do you know, like,
oh,
Billy,
yeah,
Childish.
Yeah,
we had him like very graciously supported us, but at that, around that same time, we had a compilation out on a label called Transcopic, which is Graeme Coxon's label.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what that's a funny thing. I remember us doing soundcheck at Brixton Academy, and the room was empty, but I just remember looking out and seeing Graeme Coxon walking around, sticky taping UMI posters to the walls, and that was a point where I was like, "What happened? How did I get here? Like,
I'm doing a portal or something."
Yeah, I'm doing a soundcheck with one of my favorite bands, and there's like one of my all-time guitar heroes, fucking Graeme Coxon, is sticky taping UMI posters to the fucking wall. This is mental. So, anyway, I digress. But fast forward to the to Dingwalls. So Graeme was there, and he was he kind of came and hung out with his sound check, and he was I haven't seen him in a long time, but he was such a lovely guy, Graeme. And me being a big Sid Barrett nut, we kind of just we just went down the nerd rabbit hole immediately. So so he was with us at soundcheck and with us We played the show, and we walked off, and we're just sitting in our band room, and I can't remember if it's like, I think but Billy Childish was there, and so I was like sat next to Graham, and like, you know, he wasn't drinking, so I was like, cracked a beer and opened it, and the door to our dressing, and it's a tiny dressing room at Dingwalls, the door flung open, and Noel walked in and goes, "Oh, the fuck are yous?" And looked at us, and I'm like, "Fuck, there's Noel." And but then the other side of my brain was like, "I'm sitting next to Graham Coxon."
Yeah.
And I thought, so like, you know, like,
are they gonna have a fight? Like,
yeah, it's like 13-year-old.
Don't get on. I heard about it on the news.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, 13-year-old me who like would buy the NME and Melody Makers like 2 months after they came out because they were C-mail from the train station on the way home from school was going, "Oh my god, this, oh fucking hell, this is like my mind is exploding right now," and so like I don't think Noel had even registered Graham, and then like they kind of looked at each other, and it's almost. I'm sure I'm not just like embellishing this, but I'm sure like everybody went silent as the two of them stared at each other, and I was like, "Hey!" And then Graham jumped up, and they gave each other a fucking great old hug,
oh, and brilliant.
I was like, "Wow! If that's not a moment for me to, if that's not a moment for me to." Cherish and take to the grave, then I don't know what is.
Oh, fantastic. That's brilliant. That's really nice to hear, but isn't it?
Apparently, Liam was there that night, but we didn't see him afterwards, but I remember reading in the NME a couple of weeks later, he'd punched out a photographer outside. It was outside Dingwalls, and it was like part. It was like in the little blurb. It was like a photo, you know. Like, I'm sure it was maybe 2003. Yeah, it would have been 2003. But it was like Liam punches out photographer, blah 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 blah, as he was leaving UMI's show at Dingwalls in camp. So it was like, oh, that's our little. You know, we didn't see Liam that night, but.
That's crazy.
But at least we... it was kind of nice to be a little postscript to that that moment in his, punching out a photographer, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, incident number 412.
Yeah.
I thought you were fucking out.
You just had a baby,
blood. Faggots out.
No problem, blood.
Faggots out.
Yeah, bring it.
Wanker. You're like a bad dick.
Bring it.
Come on, then. Pull your fucking cameras away now, fucking leather, you knobhead.
You don't need it.
I'll leather, you knobhead.
You just had a baby.
No, so you look like a dickhead.
Right, look.
Taking pictures of me, man. You look like a dickhead. Right. And I'll wet your fucking ass, man. You look like a fucking gay boy's ass. Draws. And I'll do you any of the time when you fucking boys ain't in. All right, knobhead. Right? I bought you with a geezer, because you look like one. You fucking wanker.
My note here is, born on a different cloud bathroom story.
Yeah.
That's intriguing. Please carry on.
Yeah, okay. So Oasis were out in 2005. Actually, it was the... obviously Don't Believe the Truth tour. And Tim, who I play in UMI with, we were up in Sydney at the time they were playing there. Even though we both live in Melbourne, but we saw the Sydney, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to see any of the Melbourne shows because I had other shows of my own at the time. So we went along to that show and went back afterwards and had a chat to Noel, and we saw Gem, and Gem was like, I think Gem was really stoked to meet Tim because I think Gem was, you know, I think Noel had kind of maybe put him onto a couple of the early UMI records, and and Gem's like, "Oh, come and let me show you this guitar I got." And Tim has these custom built guitars that are based on a really old late 50s kind of Rickenbacker shape. And Gem took us up to the stage and went to his guitar rack and pulled out this guitar that was like, he was like, hey Tim, I got, you know, like I gave this guitar builder like pictures of your guitars, and like he made me this. Yeah. So he like, which I thought, you know, it was a kind of, you know, I think at the time Tim was like, they're my guitars. They're mine. But I think like, you know, like Gem was very, very gracious, and so we had those Sydney shows, and then they played in Melbourne probably about a week later, and I was out in the city. Out in the city of Melbourne, at a bar somewhere, and my friend Nick Sester, who's the singer in Jet, he gave me a call. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm just in the city having a drink with my girlfriend. What are you doing?" He was like, and he worked out where I was, and he was like, "Oh, I'm just around the corner. I'm having dinner with Liam." I'm like, all right. Okay. Yeah, we just finished dinner.
Dust, do you want to come? As you charge off like in a cartoon.
Yeah. And my girlfriend Kat was like, go. So I'd like
run to him.
Yeah. Run to him. And I ended up at this restaurant with Nick and Liam, and Liam is kind of in his own inimitable way is just kind of like talking at everybody, and I can't remember what we talked about at the restaurant, but Nick floated the idea of, oh well, let's go back to my place and we'll get some drinks and we'll just go back there. And so, okay, that sounds great. So we drove around Melbourne trying to find the one 24-hour bottle store that was open, and we found one. I remember going in, walking in there with Liam, and Liam just grabbing bottles of whatever he could kind of pull out of the fridges and putting them on there. And I was like, I'm happy to, I can chuck some bucks in. And he was like, you're fucking serious? He's like, I'm fucking... You're fucking serious? Do you know how much fucking money I have? And I was like, okay, all right, fine. You buy the drinks then.
That's I'm happy.
You know, I think by that point I'd already spent hundreds of dollars on Oasis anyway, so I thought,
yeah, it's okay, fair. Well, fair. Yeah,
it, yeah.
You paid your share over the years.
Exactly, yeah. So we ended up going back to Nick's place, and we just sat around. We sat around, and Liam was like, okay, play me some Australian music. So we played there's a great Australian band called the Easy Beats. One of the founders of the band was George Young, whose younger brother was Angus Young of AC/DC. Right. So they were kind of like the forebears. They were kind of garage rock band in the mid to late 60s, but they were the forebears of what turned into AC/DC.
Yeah,
so,
Friday on My Mind, right?
Friday on... Exactly, yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Even my old man looks good. They just don't go. Freddy goes too slow. So we sit around, and Liam's like, I'm not into this. It's like fucking Joey and the Pacemakers. And it's like, no, it's not. Like, and so it's like, let Liam walked up to me and was like, I think we were just like kind of sitting around, we were just like, stood around a table drinking anyway, like, and Liam came up to me and was like, I got a theory, right? I was like, okay, what's your theory? And he's like, why no good bands come from Australia? I was like, oh, okay.
Carry on.
Well, I would beg to differ, but carry on. He goes, he put his nose right up to my nose and goes, it's the fucking sun.
Yeah.
I was like, what? It's the sun. Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, well, yeah, it's sunny here, and the climate is even though it is as tumultuous as it is in England as well, but I guess Australia is known for its idyllic climate, and I said, oh, well, I guess because the weather's nice. You know, he was like, yeah, that's right. Like, if I was an Australian, I'd be down the fucking beach, like waxing my surfboard and looking at birds. He said all the good bands come from England because there's like the weather's fucking shit. So we all fucking sit around and write fucking great songs, you know, just sit around and fucking write. And he was like, and then he said, oh, look at it, you know, been passed down through history, like all the fucking great bands. He held out the palm of his hand and pointed his fingers like 1, 2, 3, 4. So he's like, you look at the Beatles, you look at the Stones, you look at Oasis, you look at the Who. And I love how he put Oasis before the Who, which is, you know. Yeah, yeah, it's like Beatles, Stones, Oasis, The Who, all this great bands in the world come from England because the weather's fucking shit.
And you didn't say, what about the Beach Boys? What about the Turtles? Well, what about the Mamas and the Papas?
That is actually a very good point, isn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I'd say I completely agree.
Yeah. I was like, okay, that's fine. So we sat around and Nick had an acoustic guitar in the sitting in the corner of his room. Liam actually picked up his guitar and played us. I remember it from the title because it came out later. He played us "Boy with the Blues."
Oh yeah.
That was that like a B side off one of the Dig Out Your Soul songs.
Yeah, it was like a bonus track, I think. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, it was on that bonus disc. But I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. Like, and it was another one of those kind of like, how did I end up here? Like, this is like, we're kind of already three sheets to the wind. It was like, you know, 1:32 in the morning and like. And he was talking about the songs off, I was like, off Heathen Chemistry and how that, you know, like, obviously with anything that any of those guys do, it's like, this is the best thing we've ever done. Like, this is the greatest record ever. And I said, do you know what my favourite song is? Born in a Different Cloud. And he goes, oh. And I wasn't just, I wasn't just saying that because it was his song, but like, I was like, I actually really love that song. And he was like, oh, it's fucking great. And he was like, in my newly found sense of confidence and I said, oh, I know how to play that. I learned it on guitar. And he goes, no, you fucking don't. And I was like, I do. I know how to play it. And he goes, I'll bet you 50 quid you don't know how to play it from start to finish. I'm like, all right, you're on. So I went and got the guitar out of the living room and I went back into the bathroom. At which point, Liam is just like sat in the bathtub, like I'm fully clothed, so you know, like, yeah, okay. Cue Norwegian Wood reference. She told me she worked in the morning and started to laugh. I told her I didn't and crawled up to sleep in the bath. But he's sat in the bathtub and he was like, all right, fucking play me Born on a Different Cloud. So I started playing it and I got to the bit where the vocal comes in and I kept playing it. So, oh, wait a minute. If I'm going to play it, you've got to sing it. And he was like, all right, okay, all right.
Oh,
so,
no.
Yeah, so I'm sitting on the toilet and Liam is in the bathtub and we play Born on a Different Cloud from start to finish. And it was one of those things where, like,
you should have recorded it, man.
I know. It's yeah, easier to say in hindsight, I guess. But but we got to the end of it, and I said, "All right, Liam, £50, come on." And he was like, "You are chord wrong in the middle."
I knew
that record so well. I mean, for all it's like, I mean, there are some tracks of filler on that record, but for me, like, I first heard Stop Crying Your Heart Out when the record leaked or something online.
Yeah.
And I heard Stop Crying Your Heart Out and thought, oh fuck, this is amazing. They're back. They're back. Yeah. And so that, like, the good bits of that record are so good, but
yeah.
You know, for all your, like, you know, A Better Man and She's All in the Mind and She Is Love, I can kind of take or leave, but
yeah. But just focusing on Born a Different Cloud, I mean, it is interesting that on that album you've got these two other tracks written by Liam, which is basically two or three chords, you know, Batman and
Songbird, like, which is
are
like
both
a
good,
like a
yeah a, yeah they're both a, good like, songs a, but they're so simple.
Yeah.
And then have this bizarre, epic kind of, you know...
Exactly, yeah. No,
he didn't,
like, I mean, there's not a chance in hell that he, like, he... I think the story was, like, maybe Gem helped him with the chords, or maybe Johnny Marr, I'm not sure.
I think Born on a Different Cloud is... I don't think he wrote it. I think he's lying. I think somebody else wrote it. I don't think I was when he played it to me, I was like, fuck, you know, and his lyrics are mega, you know. Born on a different cloud
from the ones that have passed out. There are all those kind of, actually, I do have my guitar here, so
hooray.
Actually, I'm going to have to read. There's all those kind of chords, like those kind of weird ringing chords, which are almost like Andy Partridge XTC chords, and I don't know if... Yeah.
When they talked about it at the time, I mean, Gem said that, you know, Liam will kind of, because he's not a trained guitar player, that he would just come up with weird chords, and you think, well, what is it you're playing?
Yeah, right.
He doesn't even know, because he's just puts his fingers in certain places and thinks that sounds good, and he'll just hit that for, you know, over and over again for 20 minutes. And and get
which
into a groove
is the
on
true...
it. And then, so it could be that, and then maybe Gem's helped him to actually, you know, put it together.
To structure it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the impression I get from their relationship anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, I mean, obviously with that song, there's such a strong kind of like solo Lennon, but also wide album kind of vibe to it. The way the bass does that, like boom, 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 which is kind of like Happiness is a Warm Gun or something like that. Talking to myself. Actually, I just thought, on a different cloud. The past of me. Class is scarred and free. I mean, I always thought that was like a really cool change. Which I thought is, again, I go back to the White Album because it's kind of like a glass oniony kind of flat.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's kind of like got that same kind of, you know,
well,
the drone on the bottom. And
like, yeah, it's almost like the James Bond theme, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. For sure.
No, it's interesting. And what I always thought, especially in that one, is when it goes to the middle eight, that talking to myself.
To myself again.
Yeah. That is a. And then that next bit where it's like, funny how you think, funny how do 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 do. That isn't right. You know what I mean? It's not. Noel wouldn't think of that. Because it doesn't.
No. Well,
it doesn't make sense, but it does make sense in a, like, going back to Syd Barrett. It's the sort of thing Syd Barrett would have done. Because
absolutely,
but I think maybe someone like, you know, someone that's well versed in song structure would go, no, that doesn't, that's not right, and it
that doesn't fit
naturally, but whereas he, because he's not, that you do get these moments of, oh, that's okay, what happened there, and because our brains are kind of attuned to what it should be, so when it comes in differently, we do go, oh, all right, that was strange.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, like, it's all the music I love takes, I like music. I mean, I guess that's why I love like Syd Barrett and like XTC so much. It's like, I love music that keeps me on my toes. It's like, you don't know where it's going to go to next, but sometimes it's jarring, and sometimes it's a huge release after a long kind of section of tension, like, which and I think, like, with Syd Barrett, he was obviously doing it knowingly, but like there was an element of, he was not a trained like songwriter or a trained guitar player. It's like you can't put an F chord next to a B chord, it doesn't sit in the
chromatic
in the
scale,
harmonic.
He says, no, I'm going to, because it sounds weird.
that's probably a prescient point to make about some of Liam's songwriting, is that, like, it does take those unexpected kind of left twists and turns, but probably not by design, but probably because, you know, always, like, I mean, it's like the thing of the Beatles in the studio, they would, like, you know, somebody would make a mistake and they would go, that's it. That's the change we need to make. So
I suppose I've always viewed it as, you know, people like yourself who know what you really know what you're doing, you know what the rules are, and then you know how to break the rules. Whereas I don't think Liam kind of knows what the rules are, and so he just does what instinctively feels right. And and you think, oh, okay, that's... But you know, and it's just a different way of doing it. I wish we'd have a bit more of that. You know, we've sort of said for a while. You know, it's I think his last album, As You Were, was really good, and I'm really pleased that he worked with those songwriters. But I almost wish that he had sort of done an album with a Gem or with someone like you, and just sort of, you know, come on, Liam, let's work together, and you come up with these bits, and I'll sort of help shape it.
Yeah. I'm gonna go into that realm now, but even though it's not a competition, but I did prefer Liam's album to Noel's last record. But in the cases of both those records, the best songs were bonus tracks. Like Dead in the Water was the best song on Who Built the Moon, and like for me, like It Doesn't Have to Be That Way was the best song on
Top.
I think maybe, I can understand why It Doesn't Have to Be That Way wasn't on As You Were, because it doesn't fit the mould of the rest of the record, but it kind of sounds like it is a bit more adventurous than the other songs, which is, like, I mean, for me, like, it kind of sounds, it's not too dissimilar from Liam singing a Tame Impala song, you know, so...
Yeah. Well, I think it's just pure pop as well, and it's like a fantastic kind of pop production on that tune, you know. And you just think, wow, you know, this could have been it. But yeah, no, I completely agree, and that's one of my strongest songs on the album. Step outside, summertime's in blue. Stand up beside the fireplace.
Well, sorry for the relatively abrupt end to that interview. We kind of ran out of time, so there is plenty more to talk to Davey about. And so I think we will get him on again, because he's, as I say, I did really enjoy hearing those stories. And I know there is a load more to say about Oasis that we could do. Also, as we said there, we did touch upon Born on a Different Cloud a little bit, but there are other people that have given me their views on Born on a Different Cloud. We will be picking up on that one again probably next week, so make sure you tune back in for that. And I can't believe I've got this far into the episode without plugging the live event. We're almost there. We're almost sold out. So please, last chance, seriously. If you want to come along, head to my Twitter. Check out the pinned tweet. There's a cool little video, actually, that Carlo of Sigs Alk fame has put together for us. So go and check that out over there. Oh, also, I forgot to mention this as well. Carlo put together a Standing on the Shoulder of Giants documentary. He used a load of archive footage from that whole period, the end of the Be Here Now tour through to the end of the Standing on the Shoulder of Giants kind of era, and I've done the voiceover for it, so it's definitely worth giving it a listen. Go to the Sigs Alk channel and search for Standing on the Shoulder of Giants. You'll find it, or I'll put the link below. That was a good bit of fun to do, and Carlo does some fantastic work. But so check out the both the Standing on the Shoulder of Giants documentary and a little video that he's done for me for the Oasis podcast live event with Tony McCarroll. But yeah, as I say, get over there, get your tickets, come on down. We'll see you on the 17th of May. It will be fantastic. But anyway, thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast, and special thanks to our patrons. You know who you are. You put your money where your mouth is, and it is greatly appreciated. You can become a patron and support the show at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where we post articles, bonus episodes, episodes early, all kinds of good stuff. Follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Oasis Podcast. Email me oasispod@gmail.com, and please subscribe and review on iTunes. As ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young. Hello, James from the Oasis Podcast here, and we will be bringing the podcast to you live Friday, 17th of May in London at the Water Rats. I'll be there and I will be interviewing Tony McCarroll, original Oasis drummer, founding member of the band, and the driving force behind some of their greatest songs, including Live Forever, Slide Away, and Cigarettes and Alcohol. You can be there, but tickets are now very limited. Head to eventbrite.co.uk, or if you head to my Twitter, it's the pinned tweet, you can get the link. Go on and get tickets. Come on down, Water Rats, Friday, 17th of May. Tony McCarroll, live in person, plus live music, plus DJs. It's going to be amazing. I look forward to seeing you there.